Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. A few years ago, science writer Amanda Little suited up in sanitation gear and entered a food production company called ReadyWise in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Expecting to be visiting a kind of scene from Armageddon.
The company makes food for emergencies, freeze-dried meals, shelf-stable, the kind of stuff that lasts for decades. Amanda watched as a gray-beige blend of peas, carrots, and chicken moved from conveyor belts into funnels, looking a bit like cereal, light as confetti.
The fresh ingredients are blast frozen at temperatures as low as negative 112 degrees. And then the food is placed in a vacuum chamber that causes the ice to change from a solid into a gas.
The mixture is poured into foil packages, sealed, and then it's ready to sit on people's pantry shelves for a long time, up to 25 years.
And if your food supply is disrupted, you pull this, you know, chicken-flavored pot pie or this maple pancake breakfast or this chili dinner off the shelf, add some water, whip it up, maybe heat it up if you have some device that could heat it, and eat it. And that will keep you alive as long as your fresh food supply is disrupted.
But you do need water.
True. You do need water.
It sounded like the kind of food science fiction writers had imagined decades ago, or like something that doomsday preppers would buy for their bunker shelves. But what fascinated Amanda about it was that the market for this kind of food has been growing quickly.
A lot of the demand was coming from communities that were experiencing environmental disruption.
Amanda says lots of factors are threatening our food supply. Climate change, droughts, storms, floods, pandemics.
One way or another, we will very likely see much more disruption in our supply. Will we have to resort to freeze-dried survival foods to survive those disruptions?
Amanda doesn't think so. Instead, she says technology and innovation are rapidly and dramatically changing how our food is produced.
They're using modern breeding tools to create heirloom crops that can withstand drought and heat. They're trying to reimagine aquaculture and make fish farming sustainable. They're finding ways to eliminate food waste. They're using drones and soil sensors and big data to grow crops with precision and fewer inputs.
On this episode, The Future of Food, we'll look at the forces that are shaping and changing the way we eat, and we'll take a look at some foods that may become far more common in decades to come. Let's stick with Amanda Little for a bit. She's a science writer and the author of The Fate of Food, What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, and Smarter World. Amanda got interested in the different pressures on our global food systems, a growing population, and shrinking areas of land that are suitable for farming.
The main way that most people will experience climate change is through its impact on food, on what they eat, on the price they pay for it, on the way that we're growing that food, and the availability and choice of foods we have.
Amanda spent several years traveling all over the globe, looking at the connections between agriculture and climate change. Climate change is disrupting food production, and at the same time, agriculture itself has a big carbon footprint. It's a driver of climate change. One of the areas she focuses on is how technology is transforming farming. For example, how pesticides could be applied in a more targeted way using a robotic weeder.
This robotic weeder developed by a startup called Blue River Technology uses a bank of cameras that use computer vision to distinguish between crops and weeds. And then they deploy with sniper-like precision these tiny jets of herbicide onto the weeds alone. So they spare the crop. And this has already, in just the 2-3 years it's been in development, managed to reduce the application of herbicides in fields by up to 90%. And it's, you know, a total game changer, you know, just eliminating broadcast spraying and getting this hyper precise application of herbicide that never ends up, makes its way into the human body.
And I guess some of these technologies would also make it possible to have less monoculture, to have more diversity within a field.
Exactly. These intelligent machines can treat plants individually, right? So they're eventually will be able to apply not just herbicides, but also pesticides and fungicides and fertilizers on a plant-by-plant basis, rather than having the same practice across an entire field. So this then not only enables us to ratchet down agrochemical usage, but it allows for more diversity in crop mixing on fields. So you could, larger farms can begin to mimic natural systems. You could have companion planting of crops that benefit each other and bring in beneficial insects in one field, as opposed to 10,000 acres of corn planted all together.
Now, I imagine these machines to be big, complex, and also incredibly expensive. Is that one of the downsides?
Yes. These are not tractors that you could fix with a wrench easily. They certainly add cost and complexity to farming equipment. There's no question about it. And in the beginning, I think they will strengthen the dominance of large industrial operators. And it will be hard for smaller, local and mid-sized farmers to make use of this technology. But, you know, over time, I think these machines will become more accessible. They can be shared by farmers in cooperatives. They can be leased, you know, during the planting and harvesting seasons when necessary. And of course, the cost will come down. And so overall, this will become much more accessible to farmers of all sizes. There are some really exciting young companies like Nutrien Ag Solutions and Hello Tractor that function kind of like the Ubers of agriculture, mm-hmm. that enable small and mid-sized farmers to lease or acquire fractional ownership of this, you know, very expensive farm equipment without having to maintain it or to learn the technology.
Amanda says technology and innovation have always been key in tackling new challenges in food production.
If you look at the grand sweep of history, every step of the way across 10,000, 13,000 years of agricultural history, you know, it's been a story of technological development. And, you know, we've been adding sort of new links to this chain of agricultural technologies. And in the last century, no doubt, a lot of those technologies that we have added to food production have been damaging, have had really serious environmental and human health impacts. But I think there have also been really important advances, and we are now in a moment where we can solve and sort of reverse a lot of the problems with industrial agriculture through much more intelligent machinery and a much more sustainable application of IT in food production.
Another term we hear tossed around now more than before is the idea of regenerative agriculture. What does that mean? Like, it, you know, in the past, it was always sustainable, organic. That was kind of the thing I heard about as people were trying to bring to our attention some of the terrible impact agriculture was having. But now I'm hearing more about regenerative agriculture. What is that?
Yeah, that is the new sustainable, right? Regenerative is the new sustainable. It's the new renewable. It's the latest catchword in climate speak. I was just at the grocery store yesterday at a Kroger. In fact, you know, this was not Whole Foods, and they had a brand of eggs that were promoted as regenerative eggs, I believe it was. So regenerative agriculture describes farming and livestock raising practices like no-till and cover cropping and silvopasture, which is the integration of forests and cropland, but practices that rebuild soil organic matter, that restore the biodiversity within that soil, and that improve farmland fertility and moisture and drought resilience and so forth. Ultimately, these are practices that also improve the capacity of soil to sequester carbon. So this is good stuff.
how does the soil become capable of sequestering more carbon when it's, quote, healthier? What is the mechanism there?
Oh, yeah. So when you rebuild soil organic matter and you restore the biodiversity of the microbes and the fungi and those beneficial sort of creepy crawlies in the soil, you build up that organic matter. You also build up the ability of the soil to draw down and retain carbon. And carbon is a substance that we all see in soil. And essentially, the darker the soil, that dark matter in soil is carbon. So when you look at a kind of pale, almost anemic-looking soil, that is carbon-poor soil. And that rich, dark, sort of oily-looking soil is very carbon-rich soil, generally speaking. And when you have thriving organic matter in the soil, you also have significantly more capacity for carbon absorption. So for every 1% increase in organic matter, an acre of soil locks away about 10 more tons of carbon. So it's really no joke. I mean, there's a wonderful story here if you look at this from 10,000 feet, which is that agriculture, which for so long has been a climate sinner, has the potential to become a climate saint, right? That the medium in which we grow our food and the ways in which we grow it could actually function as a sort of mechanism for drawing down carbon into the soil and using farmland as a form of carbon sequestration.
And what promotes this soil health, maybe we could call it? So what can farmers do concretely to get that kind of soil?
Well, they can, first of all, use a lot fewer chemical inputs, which can damage that life, that organic matter in the soil. They can introduce practices like no-till farming, which can disturb the soil and release carbon. They can introduce cover cropping that restore the biodiversity of microbes and fungi and insects and improve fertility over time.
That's Amanda Little. She's a science writer and the author of The Fate of Food: What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, and Smarter World. If you want to see the future of farming, you might have to look up. Reporter Catherine Newhan recently visited a farm near Grand Rapids, Michigan, that harvests about 1,000 pounds of basil every week. Basil is very light, so that's a huge harvest. And this farm is in a parking lot. The basil is grown inside of stacked shipping containers using an approach called vertical farming. Here's Catherine, who took a tour of this unusual farm.
To get inside, I first have to clear a few hurdles.
We'll go through the biosecurity here, and this just helps us keep all the bugs out. So we know, it's our main defense. We don't use any pesticides, so to do that, we have to be really...
That's Tyler Blair. He's director of campus operations at this vertical farm, which is called Square Roots. So first, I have to put on a hairnet and white coveralls, which are essentially adult-sized onesies. And then I'm blasted with a burst of air to knock off any lingering bugs. The vertical farm doesn't use any pesticides, which is why suiting up is so important. Let's say, for example, a couple of aphids hitch a ride on my shoes on the way to the farm. If they make it past the biosecurity and into the grow zones, they could spread quickly and ruin an entire growing cycle for the farm, which is about 4 weeks. Once we're suited up and have been blasted with air, we're ready to enter the grow zones. Every inch of space on the wall is packed with beautiful green leaves towering above us. And the smell? Okay, I grew up in an Italian household. My maternal grandparents are from Italy, and let me tell you, I've never smelled more basil in my life than when I entered this growing station.
Right away you feel it's a little warmer in here.
So it's about 83 degrees Fahrenheit in here.
Yep.
Fans circulate the air, and a bunch of equipment pumps water to the plants. The lights are also buzzing. They're a neon pink color, by the way, for optimal growing conditions.
So what's the humidity level?
84.
84.
So it's warm and humid in here. And then we got about 1,000 parts per million of CO2 in the air. Because there's so many plants in here and it's sealed up so well, we do have to supplement the CO2. You can see like our EC, which is a measure of our nutrient concentration, our pH, our water temperature, everything going on. We can control everything.
Tyler is reading those measurements from an app on his phone. The grow zones allow Tyler to control all of the conditions based on what the plant requires or grows best in. The zone that I'm in is set to the weather conditions of northern Italy. Good for basil, but I'm getting really hot in my coveralls. So how exactly does vertical farming work? Nutrients are delivered to the towers using a pump system. The water and nutrients drip down through the plants that are sitting in a combination of coconut husk and peat moss. So no soil. Then, whatever isn't taken up by the plants is caught in a reservoir at the bottom.
So all the water runs back to the reservoir where it's recalculated its nutrients and dosing and all that, and then pumps back through. It's an extremely water-efficient system. All indoor hydroponic systems are very, very water-efficient.
If growing produce vertically in hydroponic systems is so efficient, why haven't we been doing it this way all along? That was my question for Eric Runkel. He's a professor of horticulture at Michigan State University. Eric says vertical farming started back in the 70s with research funded by the Department of Defense.
The objective was to grow plants in nuclear submarines so that people who were on those submarines for long periods of time could potentially have fresh vegetables.
But that project never really worked out. Later that decade, though, a farm called Phytofarms of America was credited with becoming the first commercial sale vertical farm operation that was completely indoors. At first, Phytofarms was a General Mills pre-commercial research and development project, but the parent company dropped out when they realized the technology of the time was not ready for short-term, significant profit margins. Since then, breakthroughs in technology have really helped vertical farming take off.
We've seen a tremendous advancement in indoor farming, and a big part of that is because of the advances in LED lighting. So LED lighting costs have come down, and their efficiencies are much higher than other types of lighting fixtures. And so that has really been a springboard to rapid development of this sector.
Eric is currently researching what light conditions work best for indoor farming. To him, vertical farming is the way of the future. It's water efficient, doesn't require pesticides, and it saves space, which is crucial.
We have more and more people on Earth, and we seem to be having less and less area for land to grow food. And so this is a solution where we can use land in a much more efficient way. We can produce crops year-round in any location. And so that avoids the challenges of climate change and the unpredictability of the weather and how that'll influence our crop.
Right now, vertical hydroponic farms can really only grow leafy greens and culinary herbs cost-effectively. Some farms also do grow tomatoes. But to make more of an impact on the food system, they are looking at how to grow produce with larger biomass, like eggplants or zucchini. For The Pulse, I'm Catherine Newhan in Detroit, Michigan.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the future of food. What will be on our plates tomorrow that we aren't even aware of today? It's hard to believe now, but in the early 19th century, soy was virtually unknown to many Americans. But over the course of a few decades, soy boomed in the U.S. to become the second largest crop, right behind corn. Most soybeans go to feed animals, not humans. But there is a ton of soy in our food, everything from mayonnaise to crackers and ice cream. Could soy's rise to prominence be replicated? Some environmentally focused farmers are pushing for seaweed to become the new soy. Alan Yu has more.
Seaweed farmers and advocates have tried to promote seaweed in the U.S. for years at this point. Their pitch, it's not only nutritious, it's a green choice in more ways than one. It grows in vast quantities underwater. It does not require fertilizer. It absorbs carbon dioxide, and it provides habitat for animals like fish and mussels. But for seaweed farmers in the US to make money, Americans have to buy it. First, seaweed farmers tried selling it as food. In many Asian countries, seaweed is a staple in snacks, salads, soup, and of course, sushi. And it is becoming more of a common food here in the US. For instance, the company Atlantic Sea Farms now has their own 27,000 square foot building in Maine, where they processed just under 1 million pounds of kelp this year, a large greenish-brown type of seaweed grown in farms off the coast of Maine. They chop up the kelp to make barrels of fermented seaweed salads, kimchi, and sauerkraut that later go in jars and are sold around the country. Atlantic Sea Farms sales director Zoe Croft says they've been growing seaweed since 2009 and only see the market expanding.
We always joke here that we say kelp in everything. Like we're thinking that kelp should be put in chowder mix or chip or jerky, salad dressings. You know, the applications are endless.
But by and large, seaweed has yet to take off as a mainstream US food. 3 years ago, I had a chance to go out on a boat to see another seaweed operation, Thimble Island Ocean Farm in Connecticut. The team pulled in some long ropes across the surface of the water. Long green curtains of seaweed hang and grow on the ropes. I talked to Brent Smith at the time, one of the most well-known seaweed advocates in the U.S., about the challenge of selling seaweed to a U.S. market.
The soy industry faced the exact same problem we're facing with kelp. And they're like, how are we going to get Americans to eat soy? And they came to the conclusion, we can't. So we'll put it in everything. And what they did was weave it through existing industries. And now you go through and look at everything from in your office to your grocery store, and there's literally soy in so many products. And so that's what we can do with kelp.
Bren made a compelling case that seaweed, just like soy, can be used in so much more than just food. It can feed animals, fertilize plants, and become an ingredient in cosmetics. US researchers are also investigating whether it can be used to make biofuel, which could, among other applications, be used for heat and electricity.
It's a game changer because we don't just have to eat it.
He said, in comparison, intensive soybean production needs vast quantities of land, resources like water and fertilizer and pesticides. And soy does have an unfortunate PR problem these days because of unsubstantiated claims that it can be tied to health issues. Seaweed, Brent said, has none of those problems. So, could seaweed follow the soy playbook and establish itself as an environmentally friendly super crop in the US? Let's start with how soy became the second biggest crop.
There was a real risk in the 1920s that the nascent soy industry would just fizzle out and become forgotten.
Matthew Roth is a historian and author of the book Magic Bean, The Rise of Soy in America. Back in the early 1900s, the U.S. Department of Agriculture had plant explorers go around the world and bring back crops that might be valuable to the U.S. One such explorer went to China, saw huge fields of soybeans, and brought some back. Then USDA farm researchers tried to establish different U.S. businesses around soybeans. They tried growing them to make hay for cattle. They tried crushing the beans to make oil. They tried grinding the beans to make meal.
All of which more or less failed.
Matthew argues the turning point in the history of soy and U.S. agriculture came in 1928. A group of mill owners got together and decided to commit to buying a certain amount of soybeans from farmers for a specific price. They milled the soybeans and combined the product with cornmeal to make animal feed for dairy cows. The corn provided carbs, the soybean provided protein. And now the soybean farmers had a guaranteed market.
And this is what really sparked farmers in the Midwest to get serious about growing soybeans in large volumes. And once you had that happen, you had this virtuous cycle emerge, which is the more soybeans expanded, the more reliable and cheap an input they became, the more investment was put into them in kind of improving them for uses such as in paint or in margarine or as a livestock feed.
And this came around the time of a farm crisis and later the Great Depression.
Kind of ironically, the 1930s were something of a boom time for the soybean.
At the time, the U.S. limited production of crops like corn and cotton to bring prices back up. The government suggested planting, among other things, soybeans, because their roots provide a growing environment for bacteria to restore nutrients to the soil. Farmers and business people in the U.S. have been throwing soybeans against the wall for 20 years. And in the 1930s, it finally stuck.
And once you have something that sticks, if it's kind of cheap and readily available, then it makes economic sense to invest in improving it for other uses.
So you grow a lot of soybeans, have a big harvest. Then people start to think about what else the beans could be used for. Like soybeans, seaweed has found uses beyond human food. Rob Moore has been a dairy farmer his whole life in New York State. More than 25 years ago, some other dairy farmers told him to try feeding his cows seaweed. They said it's a good source of nutrients and will prevent his cows from getting sick. Rob raises his cows organically, so that resonated with him. He bought some powdered seaweed and poured it into feeders for his cows.
They liked it right away. They liked it too much. Almost a wallet buster. They were eating it so much.
Back then, kelp was hard to find, and he could not afford to buy that much for his cows. One product he bought was imported from Europe. These days, he can buy certified organic kelp from a company in Maine.
We have so many less diseases that most typical dairy farmers have, I think because of the prevention, because of the kelp.
Feeding kelp to dairy cows has taken off, especially among organic dairy farmers. In California, dairy farmer Albert Strauss started feeding some of his cows seaweed 3 years ago for a different reason.
We have a law in California to reduce our methane emissions by 40% by 2030.
He found out that red seaweed could reduce the amount of methane that cows burp out, thus limiting their contribution to climate change. Last summer, he worked with researchers at the University of California, Davis, to show that this indeed works on 24 of his cows. A recent study published last year showed this could reduce a cow's methane emissions by as much as 80%. Now he plans to feed seaweed to the rest of his herd of 200 or so cows over the next year. Another promising use for seaweed is for fertilizer. Sean Barrett co-founded the Montauk Seaweed Supply Company in New York to sell kelp fertilizer. He says this is easy because the kelp they want does not even have to be good.
65 or 70% of a kelp farmer's crop would be able to be sold into the culinary sector. Then the other 30, 35% ballpark is what we refer to as like crapola kelp. Basically, it's the busted up late season, ratty, shredded, maybe it's turned brown, maybe some snails and crabs have got at it that would otherwise be just dropped, you know, kind of waste stream. We come to the kelp farmers and say, that's what we want.
He launched his business a year ago, just buying the, as he put it, crapola kelp from farmers in Maine to make into quality fertilizer.
We are up in the tens of thousands of pounds in production rate right now in mid-summer of 2022. And when we look at our projections year over year for the next 3 to 5 years, it's a straight up curve, basically, almost an infinite amount of demand out there.
Chrissy Khan, an MBA candidate from Harvard Business School, spent the summer working with Sean to learn more about the seaweed industry. She says that seaweed in the U.S. does have a lot going for it. The U.S. has a lot of coastline where farmers could grow seaweed. There's a great environmental argument, and it could plug into a lot of existing industry. But it just has not really taken off yet.
Despite the fact that our seaweed aquaculture industry in the United States has grown significantly in the last decade, what I'm realizing is that it can be hard to kind of form a nascent industry and grow it successfully when historically we've been very dependent on imports for seaweed.
Much of the seaweed that people in the U.S. use for food, cosmetics, even animal feed comes from overseas imports from Asia, which cost less than homegrown seaweed. Some states like Maine and Alaska are already producing and selling a lot of seaweed. Anushka Concepcion works at the Connecticut Sea Grant, a state program to help aspiring business people who want to sell seaweed. She saw the explosion of interest in seaweed firsthand in the early 2000s.
There's been a lot of applications that have been submitted to the state to start seaweed farms. However, we've only had two commercial farms and one nonprofit that have been actively producing sugar kelp over the past few years.
Those farms sell the kelp for food because it gets a good price. As for the idea of selling kelp for other things like fertilizer and animal feed, Anushka says that could work, but she has to see it work profitably first.
While there's a lot of really great ideas out there for non-food commodities, it really comes down to being driven by volume. It all comes back down to the economics of how much it costs to produce, how much it, a farmer can sell it for. And we just don't have that economic data yet. It's a lot of anecdotal data.
The two seaweed companies we heard from have yet to make a profit. So seaweed producers are growing the market, but it has not yet reached super crop status. But New York State just passed legislation to allow seaweed farming in the waters around Long Island. And the U.S. Department of Energy continues to fund a program studying how the U.S. could become a world leader in growing seaweed to feed humans, animals, and to make biofuel. The people who root for seaweed hope that soon its day will come.
That was Alan Yu reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. We're talking about the future of food. Earlier on, we heard about how technology is changing agriculture in the face of climate change and population growth. And similar things are happening in the fishing industry.
Given all the dire stories about depletion of stocks and overfishing, and realizing that in many parts of the world, protein from fish is the leading source of protein. Where are the fish going to come from to feed the world?
That's Nicholas Sullivan. He's the author of The Blue Revolution: Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age.
Pretty quickly becomes obvious that the answer to that is farm fish. But then the question is, will that farm fish be sustainably produced and environmentally and ecologically sound?
Yeah, let's talk a bit about farm fishing, because on one hand, it is put forth as this solution that is helping all kinds of different issues. And then on the other hand, we hear all kinds of like nightmare stories about the drawbacks of farm fishing.
One of the things I realized when I was working on this book is that most people have very negative perceptions of both wild hunting of fish and also farming of fish. And I think a lot of those perceptions date to the 90s, near shore farming with, feces on the bottom, sea lice, escapement, and all that. But both of those kind of issues have changed dramatically in the last 20 years, both on the wild side and the farm side.
Nicholas says a lot of the fish farmed today is coming from high-tech operations that actually are set up on land in tanks.
These tanks, they're huge. I mean, they're all different sizes, but, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water. Very high tech, lots of sensors, lots of machine learning algorithms and so forth to measure oxygenation, temperature, nitrogen levels and so forth. They recirculate and reuse 95 to 99% of the water. They clean it as they recirculate it, and then they reoxygenate it before they put it back into circulation. There's no escapement because they're in a tank on land. There's no spread of disease to wild fish because they're separated from the wild. It's much actually easier to control, as you might imagine, a tank on land than fish swimming in the sea.
It sounds like a cleaner system than some of the animal livestock farming practices that we hear about.
Yes, I think that is definitely true. And I mean, you know, actually, that's an interesting point in general, because, you know, farming fish is much more efficient than farming meat, you know, whether it's beef or pigs or chickens, and in terms of feed, in terms of water use, in terms of land use. I mean, you can grow a lot of fish in a very small amount of space.
You know, if I think about fish farming, I do have to say your book and what you're telling me is sort of a bit of a surprise, because I do feel like I often hear very, very bad things about fish farming, and I'm told, like, don't buy that, don't eat it. So is there perhaps a bit of a PR problem there?
Yeah, there is a real negative perception. Some of it, I think, is just a matter of people thinking, oh, this is really strange to have a farm fish, and there must be something wrong with it, even though they've been eating farmed meat for decades or hundreds of years. I think there is a PR problem. And I think, you know, there are a lot of groups that are really opposed to it. You know, wild hunter fishermen are opposed to it in general. I mean, they feel threatened by the rise of farm fish. There are a lot of forces kind of aligned against it, and also a lot of perceptions and facts that are dated, I think.
That's Nicholas Sullivan. He's the author of The Blue Revolution: Hunting, Harvesting, and Farming Seafood in the Information Age. Coming up, do you know where your caffeine is coming from?
There was at least one plant in China where they did have, like, really filthy conditions.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Behavioral Health Reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the future of food. So far, we've heard a lot about the challenges facing food production. And of course, our habits as consumers and cooks play a big role in the system. Adam Ragusea is a popular internet cook with millions of followers.
I'm a nerd who eats and reads a lot.
His videos are a mix of information about nutrition and cooking, like why does oil splatter all over the stove when you're putting things into the pan.
And what's exploding is the water. The water hits the hot oil, it expands.
And he has recipes that are no-nonsense and easy to follow, like for a mushroom risotto.
The stock is based on dried mushrooms, a little handful per portion.
These days, Adam is thinking a lot more about sustainability when it comes to developing recipes. He's using less meat and fish and trying to find ways to cut down food waste. When he's developing a recipe, he tries it over and over to make sure it works every time. Because if it doesn't, it could mean that thousands of his followers might cook something that's terrible, something that ends up in the trash.
Especially imagine if it's like a chicken, like I'm a one-person chicken death squad if I put out a bad chicken recipe.
But even if something you made doesn't turn out great, Adam says, don't throw it out.
The answer is just eat it. Like, just eat it. Unless it's going to hurt you, like, you don't have to like it. You don't have to like it. We've gotten so wrapped up in food being this thing that is a constant source of joy for us. And it can be an occasional source of joy of that level. But don't get too precious about it, for God's sake. It's still just gas that goes in the tank. Like, if it's edible, it's not going to hurt you. Just eat it. You don't have to like it.
Do you think that's one of the things that might have to change going forward? You know, we have very high expectations of our food, of the quality, of the availability, of what I can get and when I can get it. And I wonder if that's sustainable for the long haul here.
Of course not. Of course not. It absolutely is not. Food has gotten way too good. We are absolutely helpless. Helpless little manipulated children in the face of the awesome power of today's food, which, although a lot of it is bad, most of it isn't actually bad. It's just middling or kind of mediocre, right? Most of us don't encounter actually bad food anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Middling is fine, especially when it comes to sort of basic sustenance like food. So yeah, I think we got to get over this expectation that everything has to be great.
Another expectation, Adam says, we might have to scale back going forward is the wide variety of food that we've gotten used to, eating so many different things all the time. Adam says less variety is fine, and here are some of his staples.
Beans and rice for a lot of meals, and my favorite thing to eat, which is vegetable soup. Cut up vegetables and put them in a pot with water and boil it. Salt. It's fine. It's good, you know? And like, not only is it like fine, it's like great, especially if you just put a little, you know, vinegar in there for some acid, float a little olive oil on top, some fresh herbs. Like, that's my favorite thing to eat.
That's YouTuber Adam Ragusea. His channel talks about recipes, food science, and food culture. Adam just said, don't get so precious about food. It's just gas in the tank. But I think many people, myself included, are pretty precious about the beverages that keep us going throughout the day. Coffee or tea. That perfect smell, the taste, and of course, the caffeine. Coffee and tea production globally is threatened by climate change. Changing temperatures and droughts are affecting the quantity and quality of the harvest. So, what will that mean for those beloved beverages and the buzz of energy they provide us? Grant Hill looked into the future of caffeine.
People adapt their eating and drinking habits to new products and market forces. Take this for example. In 2015, a survey asked 1,000 Americans about their preferred brand of a breakfast staple, maple syrup. Only about a quarter of respondents chose a product derived from actual maple trees as a favorite. The rest sided with big-name brands that rely on corn syrup rather than real sap. For pollsters, it was no mystery as to why. At the time, real maple syrup cost more than 5 times as much as imitators, a price trend that is likely to continue as climate change bears down on real maple syrup production. So lots of people have already gotten used to the fake stuff, but that's syrup, more of a breakfast condiment than a necessity. What about the thing that many of us, certainly me, consider the most important part of our mornings? Caffeine. The psychostimulant that 4 out of 5 Americans consume every day, according to the FDA. As climate change threatens production of tea and coffee, where will that morning kick come from?
For a lot of people, they're surprised that we actually consume less coffee than our grandparents did.
That's Murray Carpenter. He's a journalist and author of
Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us.
He says that a shift from natural caffeine sources like coffee and tea to something different, something synthetic, has actually already happened.
We consume a lot more Coke and soft drinks, and more recently, energy drinks. So it's been a big shift.
According to Murray's research, that shift happened all the way back in 1975, when soft drinks officially supplanted coffee as America's favorite overall beverage.
Why that happened, you know, I think you'd have to go to, you know, some really aggressive and terrific marketing for soft drinks.
And along with the ad campaigns, Murray says it was caffeine, not high fructose corn syrup or trace amounts of cocaine, that fueled the success of companies like Coca-Cola.
When Coke, for example, was really getting started, its primary source of caffeine was from Monsanto, which was then sort of a fledgling chemical company. And they were extracting caffeine from like waste tea leaves. So, you know, sort of substandard tea leaves. But of course, the caffeine would be just as good as any.
After World War II, companies like Monsanto and Pfizer no longer wanted to rely on importing foreign caffeine crops for a fix. So they started to synthesize caffeine from raw chemicals. Today, most of the caffeine found in sodas, energy drinks, and other processed products is synthetic, generally made from chemicals like urea and methyl chloride. For decades, synthetic caffeine was produced right here in the U.S. Then, one afternoon in 1995, a mysterious yellow cloud began to waft over the Thames River in Groton, Connecticut. It came from a manufacturing plant run by Pfizer, from their caffeine building. It was a leak, nitrogen oxide, a pollutant that can be harmful to those with asthma and weakened respiratory systems, spewed from the facilities, workers evacuated. Murray says that after that incident, caffeine production and its pollution was mostly moved overseas, especially to China. Murray wanted to see that production firsthand, but it was,
in a word, frustrating. You know, I approached caffeine manufacturers in Germany, India, China.
They all either said no or just didn't respond, except for one Chinese facility.
There was one plant that hadn't actually said no, and it's the world's largest caffeine plant.
They didn't outright reject Murray's request, so he traveled there.
So it was in kind of a rundown industrial park.
Murray said the area stunk, like cat urine. When he arrived at the plant's gate, workers were friendly, but ultimately refused him entry. And he's not the only one who had a hard time getting into these places.
Caffeine is like a lot of drugs. A lot of our drugs or, you know, pharmaceutical components are now produced overseas. And so, like many of the other pharmaceutical products, FDA inspectors don't have necessarily an easy time getting access to these plants and doing their inspections. Just from the regulatory record, I know there was at least one plant in China where they did have like really filthy conditions.
Dirty mops, rusty equipment, workers wearing open-toe sandals.
And that 15 months after FDA inspectors went through there and found some really nasty conditions, Coke was still buying caffeine from that plant.
Murray notes that it would take a lot of impurities in synthetic caffeine to cause bodily harm to consumers. But the truth is, nobody really seems to care where their caffeine comes from.
Overall awareness among consumers of whether caffeine is natural or synthetic is fairly low. However, there are brands that make that use of natural caffeine sources a prominent part of its overall branding, particularly in the energy drink segment.
That's Caleb Bryant. He's a market researcher at a firm called Mintel.
I write reports on the U.S. beverage industry.
Caleb watches this space very closely, and he says although the energy drink sector has experienced huge growth, the importance placed on the caffeine source is still more of a gimmick than a real concern. At the same time, he notes interest in good old coffee is up among young consumers.
It's a growing industry, particularly ready-to-drink coffees, so canned, bottled coffee beverages. Growth stemming in large part from millennial and Gen Z consumers. Gen Z in particular are huge fans of iced coffee beverages.
But with climate change threatening coffee and tea production, he says companies are keenly aware of the changes that might lie ahead and how they'll have to adjust.
You know, at the moment, supply chain issues are continuing to wreak havoc on the food and beverage industry, but I think brands are taking a more long view of this, where climate change is that existential threat to natural coffee production. And it's really ultimately like, what is the future have in store for us? Are future consumers going to be able to enjoy universally loved products such as coffee, wine, chocolate, or is it going to be more of a luxury good or even more synthetic products on the market?
As Caleb says, the outlook right now is existential, but he says companies are already working on alternative coffee products.
Made from upcycled date pits.
They don't sound quite as enticing as normal coffee.
And it's made from ingredients such as barley, rye, chickpeas, and chicory.
And some products would definitely require adding caffeine from some other sources.
A team of researchers in Finland created the first cup of coffee produced using cellular agriculture.
This is an approach where you grow the plant cells in a lab, in a petri dish, basically. Whatever tomorrow has in store, journalist Murray Carpenter is confident that while consumers will definitely stay wired one way or another, the future of caffeine will be a bit less varied.
We have been in probably a golden age of abundance and availability of some really top-notch, well-produced, tasty, caffeinated products. I think that that production will definitely be challenged in the future.
That story was reported by Grant Hill. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. We had help producing this week's show from Sarah Kirsten. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.